If you can keep your head when all about you are losing theirs and blaming it on you. If you can trust yourself when all men doubt you, but make allowance for their doubting too. If you can wait and not be tired by waiting, or being lied about, don't deal in lies. Or being hated, don't give way to hating. And yet don't look too good, nor talk too wise. If you can dream and not make dreams your master, if you can think and not make thoughts your aim, if you can meet with triumph and disaster and treat those two imposters just the same, if you can bear to hear the truth you've spoken, twisted by knaves to make a trap for fools, or watch the things you gave your life to broken, and stoop and build them up with worn-out tools.
All right, guys. Thank you for joining the My First Amendment Right podcast. I'm your host, Christopher Ash. Today, we have a very special guest with us. We have Ian Smith. Ian, I've been following you now probably since the pandemic is when I first heard about you. But for those who are tuning in at this moment, could you give people a little rundown of on what kind of brought you into the national headlines? What happened in New Jersey?
Sure. So, you know, I was a business owner, a small business owner. I'd been in the fitness industry for now I've been in there for well over 15 years. At the time of COVID, it was about, you know, I was coming up on my first decade. Worked as a personal trainer for years, worked in every corporate, you know, fitness setting there was. And eventually I decided that, you know, I could do it better, and that I was going to go out on my own, be a personal trainer. Was wildly successful kind of right off the bat. I got lucky with a lot of things. Social media was kind of the wild, wild west of marketing at that time. And I just did really well just showcasing my clients and built a very, very successful personal training business in a matter of a year. Scaled that a little bit, made my own studio and kind of hit the ceiling again a couple years later. And in 2019, my studio was located inside of a nutrition store. And, you know, we sort of worked alongside of each other and you know, co-opted the space. And there was an opportunity to buy a gym. And the gentleman who owned the nutrition store brought the opportunity to me. And we kind of jumped on it. And we jumped on it quick. And we kind of went head first. We didn't really even do due diligence. The gym that we bought was an absolute dumpster fire. And we knew that, but it was much more of a dumpster fire than we actually knew. But, you know, it wasn't really about that. We saw an opportunity and we took it and we went all in. I put my life savings and then some in. I had to borrow money to get it done. But we did. And we were wildly successful right off of the bat. This place just needed some love. It was just a neglected business, and we knew the value of what health and fitness brings to the community. We knew, you know, our competency and that we could execute. So we just did. We just, you know, worked and turned this place around pretty much immediately. So we were successful and it was on the up and up and things were good and kind of minding our own business, enjoying the, call it the feel-good nationalism under Trump. You know, business was good. Business is never easy, but, you know, people had money in their pockets. It was a good time to be in business. And then along came, you know, the bat soup flu story. And it was like, you know, it was like one of those things where like you hear the news and it's so different these days because I don't think people nearly paid attention as much, back then. Like now, like everybody's dialed into the news and politics. And, you know, back then it was kind of like, oh, did you hear that thing on the news? Like there's a, you know, the virus in China and then all of a sudden, you know, everybody knows this part of the story. The hysteria started to kick in. The first cases came to America. And then there were like whispers of martial law. And we were seeing videos of bodies dropping and, you know, on CNN. And then the order came to shut down. Just, you know, and it was like one of those moments where we were like, what is going on. And as two business owners that had only been in this business for 9 months, it was wild for us to even consider shutting down. I mean, we had so much momentum, but we hadn't taken a paycheck at all. We sort of dumped everything right back into the gym. Any profit we made, you know, there was so much work to do. And fortunately, we didn't need to take a paycheck. We could take that time and invest in our business. And then you're going to tell us to shut down. So obviously, we were very skeptical. You know, I'm aware back then I was aware of the idea, that, you know, you typically don't want to give the government powers that it's never had before, because typically they don't give them back. You know, but at the same time, we didn't know enough, you know, to confidently say no and stay open. So we shut down just like most people did. But we paid attention very, very quickly. We wanted to know what we were afraid of. So we studied the science, and we wanted to know who was making these decisions. So we watched the politicians, and very clearly it was red flag after red flag after red flag. Our biggest red flag was when Trump signed the $2.3 trillion economic stimulus plan that most people don't know this, but they actually wound up spending around $6 trillion. And in the signing, you can see that video. When Trump signs that executive order, he brags about it as the single biggest spending bill in all of history. And they he says that there's room, you know, there's sort of room in it to spend upwards of $6 trillion. And that's a lot of money. And that's a big red flag. I don't care what side you're on politically. If politicians are that comfortable spending that kind of money, I want to know what's going on. So we read what was in the bill, and that was everything we needed to make the decision that we made. You know, again, a lot of people know what was in there, but not a lot of people know everything. You know, and one of the things, you know, everybody knew about like the hospitalizations, how hospitals were being incentivized with federal money. But, you know, if you remember back to the early COVID days, they were telling everybody to get tested, even if you didn't feel sick. Get tested, even if you don't have symptoms, which is a ludicrous concept when you're talking about health. That's the first time that's ever been like said, and people are like, okay, yeah, that makes sense. It's like, you don't take Tylenol if you don't have a headache. So we saw in here that the federal government was actually incentivizing the states, again, monetarily, on a state-by-state basis. More densely populated states were given less money, but like in the state of New Jersey, for a positive PCR test, the state was getting, I think it was $13,000 per positive PCR test. In places like West Virginia, it was quadruple, 10 times that, actually.
Per test.
And remember, we're talking about $2.3 trillion, upwards of $6 trillion. There's money in there. And it was all labeled as COVID emergency funds. So there's zero accountability as to where that money was going. So we said, wow, that seems kind of weird. Okay, so you're telling us if we don't feel well, if we don't have symptoms, we should still assume that we're sick, and then we should go get this test. Okay, right. What's this test? And again, right, this is a lot of people do know this, but a PCR test, we looked it up, and a PCR test is not a diagnostic tool. It's not something to, it's a research tool. So what a PCR test is not say, hey, yes, you have an infection. It says, here's one molecule of this. I'm going to blow it up so that you can study it. So that's why things like Coke cans were coming out as positive. So that was like the big red flag there. It was like, wait a minute, you're scaring everybody, telling them to go get a test with something that doesn't actually test them appropriately. And then you're paying the states out to do it.
Right.
And that and many other things, you know, to make a long, long, long story short, influenced our decision right then and there. We said, absolutely not. We're not going to be a victim in this. It's not right. We're not going to do this to ourselves. We're not going to do this to our family. And we're going to show people that, like, you can stand up for yourself when the government is wrong, and you have to, you know, because everybody else is staying closed, and Home Depot, Walmart, all these places are making tons and tons of money. And I'm watching small businesses all around my community close their doors forever. multi-generational businesses. And for anybody who's in business, business is never easy, even when it's good. Making money on your own, being an entrepreneur, whether you're an owner operator or you run a business, is never easy. And most small businesses are only a couple of bad months away from being upside down. There's not millions of dollars of funding sitting in the account. Small businesses provide livings for people, the owners, the managers, the employees. There's not this huge cash reserve in most small businesses. So, you know, it was like, we're not doing this. You know, this doesn't make sense. We don't understand what you guys are up to, but we know very clearly that you're lying to us and that there's a lot of money being transferred and none of it is coming to people like me, you know, the average American. So we made a plan. We didn't want to open just to open. You know, we wanted to be prepared. We knew we were going to come under heat. So we took 6 weeks to prepare. We studied everything we possibly could. We read the academic literature, and we crossed our T's and dotted our I's and made sure that we were as bulletproof as we could. I made an announcement video on my Instagram at the time that was, you know, just like a regular fitness Instagram with a couple thousand followers. And it was like the right message at the right time because I pressed send on that video and I never saw more activity on my account up until that point. There were comments coming through. It was getting like thousands of views. And that was kind of the first, other than the decision to stay open, that was the first step. A day later, Tucker Carlson called me and asked if he said, is this Ian Smith? You know, do you own the gym in New Jersey? I said, yeah, who's this? He said, you know, this is Tucker Carlson's producer. You want to come on the show and talk about this?
Yeah.
I said, fuck yeah, I do.
Yeah.
And that was ultimately the can of gas that, you know, that that was thrown on the fire. After I did that Tucker Carlson interview, I think I opened up my phone and I had like 40,000 followers like that had just followed me within minutes.
Right.
So there was a huge amount of momentum in the beginning. And then we threw our doors open and we went into a 2-year battle with the state of New Jersey and Governor Phil Murphy. Wound up accumulating millions of dollars of fines. We were arrested. We were criminally charged. We were civilly charged. We had contempt of court, both civil and criminal. We had 4.5 years over our head. We had our assets seized. I had my Venmo, my Cash App, my PayPal, my Zelle all suspended and seized. They tried to go after us personally. They did get a lot of my money from Cash App and Venmo, a couple thousand bucks, but they took $200,000 from our business bank account. They put us through the ringer and they suspended our business license. I mean, they were backing up our plumbing. They were trying to shut off our electric. They were doing everything they possibly could. It was a nasty battle. But we stayed open the entire time without closing every single day. The only day that we were closed was the day that we got arrested. And then we came right back. And it was it was like the most absurd battle because it just kept escalating and escalating. And eventually the state just kind of gave up and quietly retreated into the courts. And we're like 4 years out from it now. And we've had some minor victories in court. It's a very slow battle going back against the state. It's very funny, you know, in those days of the battle, we would get a call from our attorneys and be like, get ready for court. And we'd be like, when? They'd be like, an hour. And then we would just get railroaded in court. I mean, they had us on Zoom muted. So we were just like sitting there, couldn't speak for yourself, just getting absolutely railroaded. And then just being like, all right, well, we'd be at work. So we'd be like, all right, well, you could hear it was as stressful as it was, it was a funny situation because all we did was say, fuck off. No, you know, and it's like, we're sitting there in court and you can hear like the music blasting in the background and like the weights banging and like somebody celebrating like a huge deadlift or something. So it was such a joke, you know, but they were really, really trying to just destroy us. And they did with a lot of businesses because we weren't the only ones who were open. There were a lot of other businesses that opened. Some did successfully, you know, some did quietly. And there were others who opened and, you know, I'll never forget Tin Horn Flats was a restaurant in LA. And they opened and the city of LA, through another escalating battle, actually installed a chain link fence around their building. Like not like a construction site one where they're on the stands. Like they put the chain link fence in the ground. So we got very fortunate in the end. It was entertaining. It was stressful. But ultimately the gym stayed open. The gym is still open today. And Governor Murphy looks like a clown because he tried to throw all the state's resources against us. And we were able to, with the help of a lot of people and a lot of support, just take as many punches as they had until it was just time to say, all right, are you done? So that was sort of my introduction to the world. Through those years, I was traveling, speaking all over the country at the height of COVID, and as a result of just that decision, became a mainstay for a little while, in the Republican, party. And, I was the golden pony of the right for a little while, have since been quite disowned. That's the short version of a very, very long story.
So for those of you joining us on YouTube right now, I want to thank you guys. This conversation is going to get a lot more unfiltered, so we're going to have to switch platforms. For those who watch on YouTube, don't forget to like, subscribe, and share. It's at My First Amendment. If you want to catch us over on Rumble, it's the My First Amendment Right podcast. So we're going to switch over there now. Thank you so much for watching. All right. So, Ian, about, all that stuff. Now, you recently also had won a lawsuit, right?
Yeah. So, we wound up with everything at the gym in New Jersey. We wound up sort of spread out through five different courts. We were charged initially with 80, I think almost eight, may have been over 90, 80 to 90, maybe a little bit over, municipal charges. And these were all like public nuisance, violation of a governor's orders, noise violations, zoning violations. And that's what they started to punish us with right away. And then that stuff is really inconsequential. Like violating a governor's order is not a crime. It's like a traffic ticket. You know what I mean? So they realized that wasn't going to stop us. So they took those municipal charges. They took Governor Murphy's executive order. And then they took the health department order. They also gave us a health department order to shut down, and we just ignored it. They took those three things to a state judge in the Superior Court of New Jersey, and they said, these guys are not listening. Please give us a court order to shut down. So the judge issued a court order, obviously, because he's a lackey. In New Jersey, for those living around the country, it's different state to state, but in New Jersey, our judges are appointed. They're not elected. So they don't face any consequences for their decisions, and they're obviously going to satisfy the desires of the people that are going to give them their jobs. So great system. So this guy gives them a court order, and that's where a lot of the tangible punishments came from. The fines, the subjects to arrest, potential prison time, all that other stuff. So through these battles, we've lost pretty much every time. Again, we're going up against the state of New Jersey, in the state of New Jersey, with a state-appointed judge. To expect to win easily is silly, right? And we knew that going in. But recently, all of the municipal charges were dropped with prejudice. They were dismissed with prejudice. So we wound up in a different municipality. We couldn't be in the same municipality for those charges, even though they were written in that municipality, because there was a conflict of interest. So we wound up in this other municipality, and this woman, I have to give her credit. She just did her job. She was fair. She was a human being. Did her best to stay fair and impartial, which you would want a judge to do. She gave the state and the township plenty of time to move on these charges, and they sat for 4 years. And ultimately, she made the decision after 4 years of giving them time to present some sort of case, because that's what you have to do when you charge somebody. They didn't respond one time. And that's because they knew that this stuff was BS. They knew it was baloney. And at the end of the day, nobody wanted to put their name on it in the court. you know, because they knew it was wrong. They knew it was a scare tactic. And that's how these people work. You know, when you're dealing with like big government or big corporations doing some sort of injustice to you, their plan is for you just to quit. They know they can get away with so much. And then they know that in order to be held responsible, that there's a long amount of time for the for an individual to get there. And that long amount of time comes with a large amount of money as well. You know, and not to mention everything else that comes along with it. So these people were comfortable doing that because they didn't think that we were going to keep going. But ultimately, after 4 years, the judge said these charges are dismissed with prejudice, which means they cannot be revisited on the basis that you have violated the, you know, their right to a speedy trial. And what a refreshing thing for a judge to say today. It's crazy because, like, you know, I'm praising her for doing her job, but so few people in government are actually there to do the job the right way. You know, so hats off to that judge. So she dismissed it all, says this is invalid, see you later. So that was our big victory. Now, it's a small victory, but it is a very significant victory because essentially what that's done is that's pulled one of the legs of the chair out from underneath this court order. So now you have to go back and you have to revisit the court order. But now you have, you know, something that's not really deniable for them. And they'll try and they'll fight it. So it'll go on for a little while before there's any more headway. But remedy will be had. It just, you have to be extremely patient and just understand that, you know, if you fight the state or you fight anything with big money, that this is what you're going to deal with.
So in short form, how did you get, you know, you said they seized everything, your ways of getting paid, you know, Zelle, Cash App, Venmo, all that. They took your money, took your other stuff. How did you sustain during that time?
You know, we were very, very, very fortunate. I was a personal trainer. So I still had personal training clients. I switched over to like coaching. We had our families. We had a nutrition store, which was the funny thing is the nutrition store was allowed to be open, but the gym wasn't. But they're in the same, they're in the same space. So we made just enough to survive. And again, we both had families, you know, so there was other income involved. And we were able to kind of scrap by and just make it. And people were generous to us in ways that it's immeasurable. The generosity,
besides the people immediately close to you, how are the other people able to get you funds and support?
So people, you know, we started out with like a GoFundMe, and it was just like, hey, if you want to help us with this, you know, go ahead. And, that brought in a good chunk of money in the beginning, but after a while, you know, this kept going on. So we didn't want to just keep taking donations. And people kept asking, they're like, hey, do you guys have merch? And we didn't really. We had like one rack with a couple t-shirts. Like we were still brand new. Like we hadn't even gotten to merch yet. And we were like, yeah, I mean, we got some. And as soon as we put it up on the website, it, like the 10 pieces we had like sold out immediately. You know, so I was like, hey, like this is a cool idea. Like, people still want to contribute, but it's a way for us to get back, but it's also a way for us to spread the message.
Right.
With
your bank accounts and everything frozen, how were you able to get around like to receive the
funds? Oh, we had multiple bank accounts. We had multiple LLCs. You know, we made another LLC and like transferred ownership of stuff. And the LLC was called Murphy's Favorite Gym LLC. And with money, you know, it could be in our bank account, but it couldn't sit. So what we would do is anytime there was any amount of spendable money that we could pay a bill with, we would pay ahead. So we were like months ahead on our rent. We were months ahead on our electric. We were months ahead of our insurance was covered for the next year. Because that way we didn't have any assets personally, you know, and then the corporation, anytime it got money, it was like $1,000, pay the electric,
Right.
Because
out.
they were always trying to shut us down. They tried to shut the electric down, but the electric company said, hey, they paid until August. Sorry. You know, like we can't. Or the landlord, you know, they put the screws to our landlord and he's like, man, they've paid for the whole year, you know, like they're 2 months ahead, come back next month or whatever it is. So we just had to get really creative, you know, like it was, and people were, you know, people donated supplies. You know, there were other small businesses that donated like cleaning supplies and stuff like that. Like, you know, small businesses that were in that business, you know, they would hook us up with like, you know, tons of bottles of the peroxide based cleaner that we were using or paper towels. And it was just a matter of survival. It was like, by any means necessary, these people are not going to beat us. You know, fuck them. Like,
yeah.
Any opportunity we could get to put the screws to you, to throw up a middle finger to you, to, you know, stick our tongue out. Like, we just, like, and we had to, because it would, you got to remember that these people are human. Like, these politicians are human. You know what I mean? So, like, you can get in their head. You know, one of the funniest moments that we had was, so we had people on the inside. You know, we had people who were sympathetic to us throughout the government, police officers, you know, whatever. And they were as supportive as they could be, you know, whatever it was. But there was somebody who worked in Governor Murphy's office who would send us anonymous emails. She would send us from a Proton mail. And she had a name. I'm assuming it wasn't her real name. And she would just give us updates, you know, like, hey, you know, they're having a meeting, you know, about you guys or whatever it is. And when Governor Murphy had us arrested, when we came back the next, you know, later on that day, they had boarded up our doors with like a quarter inch thick fucking plywood, which I don't know, you know, who thought that was going to stop anybody. But, you know, so we took the rest of the day off and we came back. And then, you know, I called Tucker Carlson and I said, like, hey, I'm going to have something for you tonight. Like, just, you know, save me a spot on the show. And we called everybody from the gym and went out on Facebook and said, hey, you know, we're closed now, but, you know, come in a half hour and, you know, we'll be open. And we kicked the doors in front of everybody, like the 300 style, you know, this is Sparta. Yeah. We kicked the doors in. And we did that because it was outrageous.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, we wanted to show the absurdity. Like, look at these people. They're locking our doors. All right, you want to close our doors? Okay, cool. Like, we'll kick them in.
Right.
So it was, and it was like, now what are you going to do? And that was part of the plan the whole way along, was like, show the world how crazy these people are, and to what length that they will go to ensure your compliance, no matter how absurd.
Yeah.
So anyway, we kicked the doors in and we got an email the next day from this woman on the inside. And she said, I just want you to know you are under his skin. She said, when the news broke last night, or because the news broke, you know, at night when I went on Tucker,
yeah,
that we had kicked the doors in and everything. She said, news broke last night. And she said, when Governor Murphy came in the office, you know, today, he went in his office, or, you know, I guess she's presumably sitting outside. She's like, well, he closed his office door and she's like, there was banging and crashing. You know, so we had to remember that, like, it was, it was a fight. It was yeah, no different than a fight you want to get in. You know, Mike Tyson, one of the greatest fighters ever, like, what he was known for was like getting in people's heads.
Yeah.
And we had to do that. We had to have fun. So it was like, you know, it was this interesting, just series of events that just kept getting more and more absurd until ultimately, you know, we stood our ground, which was the plan the whole time. It was just, don't shut the gym down.
Yeah. I mean, that was, you
know, yeah, we didn't complicate it. We didn't try to have all the answers. It was just, we're not fucking closing the gym. And ultimately that was all we needed, that, and, you know, obviously the support, but, you know, just the, I guess, call it the courage to know that you're right.
Yeah.
To know that you're right. And to be okay with being punished for being right, and knowing that ultimately that everything will be okay.
Yeah, that's the biggest thing with society right now. You know, we're so far removed from any real conflicts in this country that people aren't used to growing up with conflicts and going through them and seeing it to the other side. You know, and like you said, more times than
exactly.
not, when you know you're right in something, you have to be willing to stand by your convictions. And, you know, I mean, look at the people when 9/11 first happened. They're all like, oh, this is bullshit. We shouldn't be going to Iraq. And then it took 20 fucking years. All the people.
And now that's said like commonly, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like it's.
But all
that's
the
like, oh, yeah, we shouldn't have been there. But if you would have said that then, it would have, you know, it was.
You're anti-patriotic. But the people that did say it back then and the people that were smeared but stuck to their guns, now they're speaking. Now they're being paid to speak. You know, and it's like, but people aren't willing to put themselves in uncomfortable positions or willing to be ostracized from their groups, or they're afraid of cancel culture, all this bullshit. But, you know, one of the reasons I was drawn to you and your story is because, you know, that's just how men have to be.
Yeah.
You know,
that's like
honoring the Constitution. That's like honoring the people who fought and bled for this country. Is, you know, they even knew that they weren't going to live to see the fruits of what they died for, but just having the conviction of knowing what's right to do in the moment and just doing it is what we're missing so badly right now in this country.
And I have to look this up, and I'm sitting right here, so I will. The average age, I think, of the founding fathers,
like under 30,
it was like 25 or something like that. And there's a memorial that highlights some of their sacrifices, and I just pulled it up here. Carter Braxton, who's a prosperous planter and trader, his entire fleet of ships were destroyed by the British Navy. He lost his home to pay off the debts and died in poverty.
Yeah.
Thomas Lynch, he was a rice plantation owner, and he risked essentially his essential fortune. Died mysteriously. Nobody really knows how he died. People's wives were killed. People's houses were burned. People's children were killed. A lot of them suffered critical wounds. A lot of them lost everything that they've. And remember, these men came over here and built lives. You know, like many of them were not rich to begin with. They were people who either had come over here or their parents had come over here, and they had built themselves a lot life in this new country. And then all of a sudden it was contested and they were willing to sacrifice it. And, you know, I think that's fundamentally a characteristic of masculinity. You have to be willing to lose everything to protect everything.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? Like, and that's very foreign today in just society as a whole, but men are responsible for that.
Yeah.
And a lot of guys don't like to hear that, you know, and they think it's like some tough guy thing, but it's like, no, you have to stand your ground on your principles, because if you continuously just secede back and give inch after inch after inch, you eventually wind up in a position where we really are today, or a lot of men are today, where you've given up so much ground that, you know, you're like the army that's been pushed over the edge of the cliff.
Right.
You've retreated and retreated, and then when it's time to dig your heels in, there's nothing for your for your back foot to dig into. It's loose dirt. It's the edge of the cliff.
Yep.
And that doesn't happen by mistake. There's a force, you know, in this case the army, that has pushed you in that direction for a purpose, because they don't want you on the open battlefield. They don't want you, you know, to have good positioning. There's a reason that your rights get eroded quietly and, you know, one step at a time, and it's a little bit here and it's a little bit on here and then some here, and then it's your privacy and your freedom of speech a little bit and just a little bit of your gun rights.
And cumulatively,
that adds up to be a lot. And it puts you in a position to be much weaker, and it makes fighting back so much harder. But what is so foreign is this idea of like, that hard stance where you're willing to be uncomfortable in some way, whether that's confrontation, whether that's physical conflict, whether that's financial punishment, whether that's just being yelled at. You know, like, let's not forget about COVID, where most people wore masks because they didn't want to get yelled at by, like, the Walmart attendant. You know what I mean? Like, that's not that hard of a battle. Like, and you don't have to be you don't have to be an asshole to the little old lady, but you can just kind of say, no, thanks, get away from me. I'm going to go grab my groceries. And people can yell at you and they can do whatever, but you go get your groceries and you go through self-checkout. And if they don't let you, then you leave cash and you walk out. Yep. But people were like, oh, I don't feel like doing all that, man. Like, I'm just going to wear the mask.
I was in the airport. I think it was in New York. My girlfriend was with me. And she's very much the, you know, she avoids conflict at all costs when she can. And we're in the airport and I was very anti-mask. I won't go into the long spiel of it, but like I already knew it was bullshit. I mean, just because of the contradictory rules about it, right? So we're in TSA line and I'm looking at the TSA agents, right? And they either all got it below their fucking nose or they're just not wearing it. So I take mine off and they come up and they're like, excuse me, you got to put your mask on. I'm like, then put your mask on. I was like, look, either the rules are the same for fucking all of us or I'm not following any of your goddamn rules. It's not about protecting anybody. Your use is literally just about compliance. And I'm not fucking complying with this. So I put mine in a fucking awkward fucking way just so I get through the damn thing. But it's, you know, I'm fortunate that I know you went through everything in Jersey. I was down here in Florida and we only locked down for 1 month. And then thank God DeSantis was like, you know what? This makes no fucking sense. And like you said, the biggest thing that I think we don't talk about is more than 50% of small businesses in this country are gone.
Yeah.
And like you said, and did not take the moment to sit down and think about family generations that it took to build some of these and the sacrifice that these people made when they first started to take care of their families. And then within a fucking year,
gone.
It's gone. And this happened in most democratically led states and in counties too. I'd say the Republicans were generally more lenient with it and everything like that. But, you know, it got utterly fucking ridiculous. And that's like one of those things as an American, you know, we do in the 90s that big corporations, big government propaganda and all this shit and mass conformity. We're like the four biggest fucking things that you don't do as a private citizen. You know, you were the enemy if you did that shit back in the 90s. Even the bands that got famous in the 90s got famous off these principles. And now all these motherfuckers are pro-establishment.
Yeah.
I can't stand it.
So I actually, I forget where I was watching it, but it was a really interesting conversation. And the guy was talking about how the government, you know, whatever the system will co-opt certain demographics. Yeah. And in that they were talking about, you know, what has happened to the left. Because if you remember, Occupy Wall Street was a leftist movement, but they were fucking right. And they were scaring the shit out of the big corporations. You know, and that left wasn't talking about cutting dicks off and pronouns and anything like that. That was unheard of. That left was the Rage Against the Machine left.
Rage Against the Machine now was fucking rage.
Yeah, when Rage Against the Machine was, you'd listen to it and it was when punk was punk and all that. But, you know, that left scared the establishment quite a bit, and what they ultimately did is they come in and they coddle them and they get into these movements and they change the trajectory of them. You know, like they were the left was spot on with the Occupy Wall Street movement. All of their talking points were beneficial to all Americans. Yeah. It wasn't a bipartisan, it wasn't like a left versus right thing. Like they weren't blaming people on the right. They were talking about the corporatocracy that we have between big business and government and special interests. And they shook the foundation. I mean, they were a problem, and they came in, and now look at the left.
Yeah.
You know, it's a joke, but they do it with the right too. They do it very, very much with the right.
This, Ian, we got, you know, I know you have limited time here. We got about 6 minutes left before you got to go. I got five questions that I want to ask you. So just keep that in mind when you go to give these answers here.
Let's go. Yeah.
Kind of what we were just on right now. What do you think is the biggest problem in our country? And you can totally unfiltered.
Everybody wants somebody else to clean up the mess. Everybody wants to go vote for Donald Trump, and they're going to sit around and they're going to wait until that happens. And whatever you think of Donald Trump, whether you love him, whether you hate him, whatever, whether you doubt him, it doesn't matter. One man couldn't save you if he wanted to.
Right.
The responsibilities that most people, or the reason that most people's lives are not good. The economy sucks. Yeah. Stuff like that, you know, whatever, but people have gotten very complacent when it comes to taking control of their own lives. Most people don't even know who their mayor is. And they're worried about, like, you know, all these other issues that are distracting them. People need to focus on their own lives, focus on themselves first, focus on their families, repairing the connections and the relationships that really matter, getting involved in their community, and being an asset instead of just a fucking voter.
I agree.
You'll never change anything by just voting. And I'm not saying don't vote. I'm saying don't go vote every four fucking years and expect the country for everything just to be fucking peachy, because that's just not the way it works.
Yeah. And I agree. So this is the one that probably gets us banned off most platforms. What are your thoughts on the United States relationship with Israel?
Not good. Not good. There's absolutely no reason why we need to support them. You know, I could honestly give a fuck about Israel. No more or less than I could give a fuck about any other country other than the United States.
Yep.
I don't care if you want to call them an ally. We've given them an obscene amount of money through the years, and we've gotten very little out of it. People like to cope and make up these things like technology and all this stuff. You get technology from even people that you compete with on the globe. We get technology from anywhere. So there's all these copes that we need to support them, and there's all these biblical, Christians that think that somehow they're being a good Christian for doing it. And the reality is that they have way too much influence in our own government. It's easy to see. They brag and boast about it. Donald Trump talks about it. Kamala Harris talks about it. Every single federal politician is subject to their influence in some degree or another. They have a 95% win rate when it comes to federal candidates that they endorse on both sides.
Yep.
And honestly, their views don't align with us. They're a country that doesn't allow immigration, or allows very, very controlled immigration. They're an ethnostate, and they actively work around the world to destroy other ethnostates. They've helped flood migrants into Western society all throughout Europe and America. And the sooner that people will just realize that, and it's not about hate. You know, you've got so much of this, what I call low IQ anti-Semitism, where it's just about like hate. For me, it's just about calling a spade a spade. And that's it. It's not about hating anybody, but it's about holding people accountable for their actions. And if people are doing something wrong, I don't give a fuck if you're white, black, Christian, Jewish, Muslim. I'm going to call you the fuck out on it. I don't care if you're my own people.
I got you for two.
Keep that one short. I could go on that one.
I'm going to shorten the questions here. These are the.
Yeah.
Okay.
Nah, go ahead. Spit them off.
All right. Who are the bigger faggots? The hosts of the Daily Wire, Matt Walsh and Ben Shapiro, or the Krantzenstein twins?
Ben Shapiro and Matt Walsh by far. Those are closet faggots.
My last question here. What should be done about the pandemic, the pedophilia pandemic in the world?
more people need to speak boldly on it. I think you're seeing a lot of really good people who get platforms, people like Alex Rosen, who had made this like his life work. I have a lot of respect for people like that. There are some people who are getting into it who are like grifty and gay, but you have to, you know, be able to discern that. And those people should be supported. Their voice should be uplifted. And talking about it without fear of like offending people, and voicing your opinions about how we should handle these people should be commonplace for everybody.
I agree. And well, Ian, I want to thank you so much. If you want to take the moment here, I know you have some other things going on, some other projects. If you want to go ahead and plug them real quick.
Sure. You can just check me out on social media. You can find all my stuff there, involved in a whole bunch of different projects. Ian Smith Fitness on both Instagram and Twitter. While I'm there, you can catch me with anything I'm doing.
All right. Ian, I really do want to thank you for taking the time to be on here with me today. And I got to make it up to where you are for a workout with you. That's too funny that I saw you were in the state of Florida by the gym that you went to, because my mom was and I used to lift at that place as well. So
all right. Well, we'll get a good lift in. I just got on a good program. So
absolutely. Welcome to Florida, brother. We're glad to have you. Again,
all right.
Christopher Ash with the My First Amendment Right podcast. Hope you all have a great day, and we'll catch you next week.
If you can make one heap of all your winnings and risk it on one turn of pitch and toss and lose and start again at your beginnings and never breathe a word about your loss. If you can force your heart and nerve and sinew to serve your turn long after they are gone, and so hold on when there is nothing in you except the will, which says to them, hold on. If you can talk with crowds and keep your virtue, or walk with kings nor lose the common touch, if neither foes nor loving friends can hurt you, if all men count with you, but none too much. If you can fill the unforgiving minute with 60 seconds worth of distance run, yours is the earth and everything that's in it, and which is more? You'll be a man, my son.